Thank you and good afternoon. I'm going to talk a little bit about the bad guys, not necessarily the good guys, and the bad guys as they interact with the humans. So I want to give you a little bit of introduction. I want to talk about pathways. So how do the bad guys get into human systems? I want to talk about the organisms involved rather briefly. I'm going to start with the small ones and work with the larger ones. Talk a little bit about survival and movement in soil, and then hopefully have a conclusion or two. So pathogens cause disease and illness, not necessarily positive, but negative things. They may come from two different sources. They may be natural residents of the soil who normally exist in the soil, but under certain conditions can cause disease. Or they may be introduced. Often if they're introduced, they come from animals, including humans, and they survive in soil until they can be reintroduced into a potential host. So the skin is a great natural barrier between the outside world and all the good things that are inside. So the skin is a great partitioning between the pathogen and us. Some of the organisms, though, and Eric had a view of a hookworm. Hookworms are nasty. They're nematodes, and they can penetrate through bare skin. So we don't necessarily have to ingest or some of the other mechanisms. If you're walking around barefooted, you might want to give some thought to that. Though probably not a problem in Minnesota. It can be present on the soil, on the surface of the skin with abrasions. Clostridium is particularly bad on that. If you have a puncture wound where you don't have a lot of blood flow, a puncture wound tends to scab over quickly. And you can have anaerobic conditions. You have the spores from this Clostridium that will germinate. And I'll tell you a little bit more about tetanus a little bit later. Orally ingested, foodborne pathogens, and some of these are pretty deadly, like botulism. And inhaled, especially under bird rookeries where fungi grow, and these fungi can be in the air. And then you and I breathe them, and they're systemic, and then in our systems. So a lot of the guys that spend a short period of time in the soil are enteric, which means they come from warm-blooded animals. They must survive in the soil. And I'll talk a bit about survival mechanisms and things that favor survival and things that discourage survival. It's a function of soil conditions, as you might suspect, and the environment in which that occurs. Mixed group of organisms that are enterics, including bacteria, including viruses, including a number of the worms have cycles that go through the human gut or animal gut. They've got to survive, so as excreted in the environment, they've got to survive for a length of time, which means they survive the chemical and the physical environment, but also the biological environment. What happens in the rhizosphere in a root system where you've got these exudates that we heard about earlier being emitted, and we've got the natural flora in the soil, and these are not necessarily natural organisms. So they're probably not growing, these that are enteric. They're probably just surviving until conditions are right for reentry into a host. And just if you have the combination of a host and the organism, doesn't necessarily you're going to have disease. So there's a difference in the inoculant potential for disease. Salmonella, for example, you might need a million to a billion cells per incident for disease to occur, and Shigella, maybe as few as 10 cells can cause that. People with compromised immune systems are especially sensitive to all kinds of things, but clearly exposure to soil. So the threshold level is both a function of the disease and the organism and the environment and the host. Resident pathogens, some are really nasty, some are natural. They're part of the natural habitat, and they have niches that occur in the soil, and they're opportunistic organisms that when conditions are appropriate, they can cause infection. Such as tetanus and anthrax, botulism, gas gangrene. Many are spore formers in the Clostridium group, which means they can survive in soil and especially dry soil for a long period of time. Some of the helminths or the worms also survive as eggs for a long period of time. And most soils of the world that we've looked at have these organisms. A couple things on tetanus, caused by a toxin-producing anaerobic spore-forming gram-positive bacterium. There, in 2001 to 2008, 233 cases of tetanus and 13% mortality. So the U.S., we have this fairly well controlled. And if you spend time working in soil, you probably have had your tetanus shot, which is good. But other parts of the world, that's not necessarily true. In the year 2006, 2090 persons died of tetanus. A lot of these were associated with birth and the infant that was associated that died as a function of birth. Once the anaerobic tissue, the spores will convert to vegetative forms. A neurotoxin will be generated, and it affects the central nervous system and causes lockjaw. You've probably seen ghastly-looking pictures of people with lockjaw. Not a pleasant thing. And you've got your deep wounds. You've got your lack of bleeding, usually if it's a puncture wound. You've got an oxygen-derived environment and conditions that are pretty favorable for spore germination of the organism. Pathogens introduced to soil, often coming from infected humans or animals. Night soil, which is extremely important in some parts of the world where night soil is commonly used. Sewage sludge may be more common here in the United States, or municipal wastewater. Septic tank effluent, especially where you got the effluent not passing through soil. We're going to find out soil is a pretty good filter. And you've got animals and animal waste, the zoonoses apparently there's about 130 different diseases that come through animals that also can affect humans. Briefly on the different groups of organisms, we're going to start with the small guys and go to the larger ones. Viruses are usually 20 to 300 nanometers, maybe with or without a tail. They've got a capsid or protein outer coat. They've got nucleic acid on the inside, either RNA or DNA. A lot of the things that they cause are upset stomachs and diarrhea, vomiting. Give some thought to the fact that infected individuals can pass up to 10 of the 10 to 10 of the 11 numbers per gram of feces. That's going to be 10 billion to 100 billion viral particles per gram, which is a staggering number when you think about it. Larger virus, the longer the virus survives in the environment, the greater the risk for transmission. In fact, that would be true of any of these organisms. The longer they survive, the greater the potential contact with a new host. Bacteria, 1 to 3 micrometers, they're prokaryotic cells. They can live in soil or they can be transmitted through soil. Shigella, that causes Legionnaire disease, causing tuberculosis, causing botulism, causing a gas gangrene. The pharynges, just some organisms there that are naturally present in the soil, and when conditions are right, can cause infection. Fungi, a lot of the fungi are relatively benign. They can cause some rashes and things, but often we don't die from the fungi. Eukaryotic cells, you may have the dermophytes, like a ringworm, the picture that's on here. Ringworm is an ascomycete. It germinates, the hyphae go through the skin, it produces a enzyme that breaks down the keratin. It's not a worm, it's a fungus. Apparently the Romans named it ringworm, and I think they claimed everything was a worm back at that time, but we now know it's a fungus that causes the problem. And systematic, predominantly through the oral, where you're breathing in, not through the respiratory system, where you're breathing in the organism, Aspergillus fumigatus. Protozoan, and some of these are pretty nasty. Single-celled eukaryotic organisms, 10 to 50 micrometers. A number of them have a cystic phase where they can survive in soil as a cyst. So they would be ingested as a cyst. They would move through the stomach. They would attach to the lining of the intestine. And be vegetative, be germinate and vegetative, and then as they pass through the small intestine into the large intestine, dewaters the fecal material, and during that dewatering, it's a stress on the protozoans, and then they form the cyst, and then that can survive in the soil. Interesting life cycle that that they've evolved with. Giardia, attached to the small intestines, abdominal cramps, bloating, nausea, watery diarrhea, often transmitted in water, but they can survive in soil for a period of time. Parasitic worms, a lot of these are nematodes. Some are really nasty. Their life cycles are nasty. And the evolution of these life cycles is fascinating when you study them. They reproduce by eggs, often pass through stools, and they can persist in soil. Flukes and tapeworms, hookworms, pinworms, and whipworms are in that category of the helminths. Just share with you a little bit on the guinea worm. Have you heard about the guinea worm? And that second statement is really true. Life is good if you don't have this parasite. Life is not good if you do have it. So the guinea worm enters, it's a nematode egg, and there's a small crustacean in water that ingests the eggs. Humans ingest the small crustacean. The crustacean dies. The eggs germinate. They pass through the stomach, the intestine, and the perineal cavity. Mate. The males die. The females move through the underlayer of the skin, usually downward to the legs and to the feet. This whole process is taking about a year. They'll form a blister, like on the legs or the feet. This is the female, and it's producing irritation. So the person that has this irritation wants to put their foot in water. As they put it in water, that's when the worm emerges and releases its eggs. Think of the evolutionary process with that. These worms can be 75 to 120 centimeters in length. It's thought that perhaps the medical staff, that you have the snake surrounding the staff, comes from extracting the guinea worm. You would put it on a stick and you'd roll it a couple centimeters a day. If you rolled it too quick and too much pressure on it, it would break and cause infection. So it was maybe a month's process to get that guinea worm out. Life is good if you don't have the guinea worm. Survival in the soil, the residents compete for growth requirements. Along with the natural organisms that are in the soil, the transient organisms, the function of survival, the timing conditions, the fresher the contamination, the greater the potential for infection. Food grown in fertilized soils and human waste clearly are at risk, especially not knowing the origin of where that waste material is coming from. Land application is common to recycle nutrients, so that's a common way of getting rid of waste materials. May not grow, but often can survive. And if we have a growth, it's often exponential, first-order reaction kinetics. Surviving soils are grouped. The helminths and the spores, the bacteria and fungi probably persist the longest. Soils generally are a better medium for survival than plant surfaces. Just very quickly, some data by Gerben Smith about 10 years ago. Just looking at common survivals, and there's a huge difference in different groups of organisms. Just some numbers to give some thought to. 3 months in soil. And you can see that most of those in plants are less than soil. They'll miss, though, we're talking a couple of years, survival in soil. Survival in soil, things that might impact that survival. Sunlight, UV light deactivates pathogens, destroys DNA, tends to dry the environment. All these are negative things as far as survival. Moisture, usually greater die-off in drier soil. Temperature, survive better under cooler temperatures, but not necessarily freezing, as far as just the generalities as you look at the wide variety of pathogens. Texture, fine textured soil retain usually more pathogens and can act as a filter in removing pathogens that move through the soil. pH, sorption generally increases if pH decreases. A lot of the bacteria, their isoelectric point is maybe 2 to 3 a pH, which means above that they have a negative charge. Soil would have a negative charge. Higher pH, you might have calcium, magnesium serving as a bridge to bind that pathogen. Lower pH, it's perhaps aluminum or iron, which would be a pretty strong binding material. Soluble organics often compete with pathogens for sorption sites. especially in an organic soil. Organic soil that has fumic and humic acids will bind, and viruses often are noted to pass through rather quickly humic organic soils. Microbial type, surface charge, surface proteins, extracellular polysaccharides, size are probably going to impact survival and movement. Water flow rates, higher flow rates, more easily move the pathogens, less movement under unsaturated and saturated. And preferential flow, this is where you got a big crack or big hole or no root channel. Water moves down that pretty quickly, and if you don't have that soil contact, we can move that pathogen pretty good distances in the soil. Survival, cation exchange capacity is important, and neutral pH, both soil and pathogens we talked about, negative charge. We may have ionic attraction and binding. Organic matter leads to cation exchange capacity, retains moisture, a little better environment for survival. Soluble organics can also serve to block some of those sorption sites. Movement of soil, humus are approximately the size of sand particles, protozoa about the size of silt. Bacteria, fine silt, and coarse clay, and viruses, very fine clay. So we can relate the biological world to the physical environment in which these organisms are moving. Larger worms and eggs, the protozoa often are trapped by the soil matrix. Smaller bacteria and viruses are often stored by physical chemical properties on the surface of soil. A little bit of speculation, of, as Eric did, and I think I've got one or two of the same kind of thoughts that he does. Currently thought to be in the thousands of different species per gram of soil, the uncultured organisms. And a lot of these, we really don't know what they do. We don't know their function. They carry the genetic material, but what turns it on, I don't know that we've got a good feeling for. They're probably not really bad guys are in the soil right now that we've not already studied. From the standpoint that if the organisms are affecting human health, there's been a lot of effort to identify them. So I think we've got the really bad ones already identified. And this last point is something that I think is a real interesting area for the future. And we're now knowing that the human gut, and we've done some work on the microflora analysis of the human gut, that different individuals have different microbes. And from a microbial ecology perspective, we always talk about habitat and niche. So the habitat is the environment in which the organisms live. And if we introduce those organisms early in the life of an infant, those may be the ones that establish. So the organisms in the soil where that individual was born or first experienced soil. As a kid, you probably remember making mud pies. I do. Coming in with the drippings off your mouth. Your mom was horrified when you came in like that. But that may be not necessarily bad. And I think infants have been doing that for a long period of time. So as we move into more of a sterile environment, that may not be necessarily good for our kids. So conclusions, a wide variety of pathogens can live or survive in soil. Organisms are natural residents, others are introduced. Often they're shorter lived when they're introduced. Of the introduced, the fecal-oral route is the most common. Soil properties and types of pathogens affect length of survival. They usually decrease with time and logarithmically with time. Soil is a pretty good filter. Viruses most likely to escape the filtering process because of their size, and especially with preferential flow, as we don't contact that soil and things move in the profile due to gravity. And
that was pretty good timing. I was just about to tell you had less than a minute. So
1 minute, great.
Thank you, very good. Does anybody have any questions? I have a comment if nobody does. I remember reading maybe 5 or 6 years ago when you put up the slide about UV light doing a lot of the killing, and I remember reading it was in a magazine. However, it wasn't a scientific journal, that one of the reasons that we started tilling the soil was to expose the bad guys, it was bacteria and viruses, to sunlight so that they would die and not transmit some of these diseases onto, because we didn't used to do tillage. We used to poke a hole and plant something and didn't till, so. It's hard to manage and always keep everything in mind. Yeah. But
a lot of connections there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.